Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 23 of The Good, the Bad, and the Wretched. As usual, my name is Josh, and with me, as always, is Chris.
What's going on?
Not much. And this is actually the first episode where we have a special guest. And this time around, we have Matt Kelly. He runs a couple of really great podcasts. One is the St. Mort podcast, and the other is the Horror Movie Night podcast. So welcome, Matt.
Thanks, Josh. Thanks, Chris.
So, Matt, would you like to tell us a little bit about the two podcasts that you run and anything else that you do?
Well, the St. Mort show I've been doing for 5 or 6 years. You guys were actually on an episode many months ago, almost a year ago.
Wow.
Yeah, we just got started on this one when we were on there, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah, that was, I think you were only 3 or 4 episodes deep on this one when we had you on to promote the show. And that show has always been kind of just a fringy, I just want to interview people who I think are doing interesting things. And sometimes it's just close friends. There's an episode coming out in a couple weeks interviewing my friend who currently lives in Indonesia about noise bombing, which is a weird trend that happens in Indonesia that he's a part of, in which random noise musicians will just show up at a location, find an outlet, and just create noise until they're told to leave. Hmm. So that was kind of an interesting interview. But then other times it's people like my very first guest ever was George Hardy of Troll 2 and Best Worst Movie. So it definitely bounces all around in that sense.
Tell me you asked him to say you don't piss on hospitality.
I mean, you kind of have to, don't you?
Like, it's kind of a prerequisite, isn't it?
Yeah, probably the coolest of those early days was that I got to hang out with Mink Stole from all of the old John Waters movies.
Yeah, that's great.
And I just went to her apartment in Baltimore, and she had just photo albums of like her on the set of Cry Baby with Johnny Depp and her with Ricky Lake on the set of Hairspray. So that was a really cool experience. But that's basically it. As far as Horror Movie Night, which is a fairly new show. We're 7 or 8 episodes deep, depending on when this episode comes out. And that was an offshoot of something that me and the other two co-hosts, Adam and Scott, did on Reddit called the Reddit Horror Club. And we just kind of found ourselves feeling like we could expand and do more than just this movie club for Reddit, and took the similar format that we had of having people tell us movies that they want us to watch and us subjecting ourselves to those movies. But whereas the Reddit Horror Club, the people there really wanted us to have in-depth discussions, Horror Movie Night's definitely way more of trying to make each other laugh while making fun of a movie, whether we like it or not. You know, we watched Waxwork as our second movie and we all loved it, but we had, you know, there's plenty of material in Waxwork that you can also make fun of and poke holes in. So it's mostly just trying to find a way to have a good time watching a movie, whether it's good or bad. And the name kind of comes from the idea of when you were in high school and junior high and you would have horror movie nights where people would come over and you'd watch a bunch of movies. And it's very much like, well, what are the types of movies that you would usually end up watching at those sleepovers? And it's been getting some good responses. We had a huge success with Dr. Giggles.
Great.
That just, I don't even understand how we got the numbers that we got for Dr. Giggles. Apparently, there is a whole lot of Dr. Giggles fans out there.
There's more than you would actually think.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
that's
I, and I
really
think it's
crazy.
Because, and I talked about this in that episode, of all of the slasher films that I've ever seen, I feel like Dr. Giggles is that one where it's like, I really wish that this one got more got a sequel or got to become a franchise, because there's just so many things you can do with that type of killer, to tie in with what we're talking about tonight, where, you know, unlike a Jason or a Michael Myers, where they're really kind of held down to just a knife or an axe or, you know, a machete, you've got Dr. Giggles is killing people with blood pressure readers and, you know, liposuctioning
them
to death.
That's my favorite. liposuction.
So it's like, just imagine, you know, you get a bunch of creative minded people to write 5 or 6 Dr. Giggles films, just using as many medical death tools as possible, and it's, you know, that you could do at least 5 movies.
They could have a cameo from like one of the Kardashians getting her ass liposuctioned, and that would be like the greatest thing in the world, I think.
Well, it could happen now too.
You do a weird tie-in with Dr. Giggles and the dentist and the surgeon all from that same time period.
Corbin Burnson and Larry Drake. That'd be like the biggest ham fest, I think, in the face of this planet.
Hey, that wouldn't be bad. Hey, it could happen, man. All the remakes that are going on right now.
Maybe. That's a possibility. Possibility.
So what's the difference between the retro episodes and the non-retro episodes of that podcast?
So the retro episodes are actually episodes of the Reddit Horror Club. They're episodes that we recorded when we were still doing the Reddit Horror Club, but we were just starting to like get to where we ended up with Horror Movie Night, where we were getting further and further away from the in-depth discussions. And mostly the biggest point of those is that we have so many inside jokes that we keep bringing back in episodes where we were like, man, people who discover Horror Movie Night are not going to understand the origins of some of these references and some of these impressions. So it was kind of just digging through the archives of, we did almost 200 episodes of the Reddit Horror Club.
Okay.
Digging through those 200 episodes and finding the ones that do have origins to jokes that are still cropping up in Horror Movie Night.
Yeah, like Puppet Master 3. I noticed you referenced Puppet Master in the Puppet Master 3 episode. You were talking about all the references to Puppet Master 3.
Yeah. Well, okay. Puppet Master 3, there's the if you've listened to the episode, we still to this day use the phrase, "This is the best I can do for you, my dear," which is just a regular line in Puppet Master 3, and it wasn't really until we started analyzing that movie and realizing, like, he took his dead wife's soul and shoved her into a puppet that spits up leeches for all eternity. Like, that is actually not the best that he could do for her.
Yeah.
It might not be the best, but it's probably the most awesome.
Well, she's the sexiest, for sure.
Well, I know. You're like, in the first Puppet Mess, that leech woman, you're like, hey, how you doing?
Yeah, I'd hook up with the leech woman.
You probably would. You're a little bit of a horn dog over there, Josh, I think.
Yeah, and actually, it was funny when I was listening to the Puppet Master episode. You did remind me of all the Full Moon Video Zones. You guys talked about that a bit, and it prompted me to go onto YouTube, and I saw that Full Moon's put up most of the Video Zones from the old tapes on their YouTube channel, which is really cool.
Yeah, the Video Zones, in a lot of respects, were almost better than some of the movies that you watched.
It's true.
Like, there were some real stinkers from Full Moon that I watched, but I still stuck around after the credits because I always loved the Video Zone segment.
Like Seed People.
Oh, I was just thinking of Seed People, too. That's hilarious.
I see Kismet. I could read your mind because I was like, what's the absolute most atrocious Full Moon movie ever made? And it was between Seed People and maybe Dollman versus Demonic Toys. I'm like, I'm not too sure which one's worse.
No, Dollman versus Demonic Toys is a borderline masterpiece compared to Seed People.
Oh, it's also a borderline masterpiece compared to Puppet Master versus Demonic Toys. But Charles Band had nothing to do with it, so.
To be fair, too, Dollman versus Demonic Toys isn't so much bad as it's a 50-minute movie that 30 minutes of it is just old footage from Dollman, Demonic Toys, and Bad Channels.
So it's like Silent Night, Deadly Night 2.
Yeah.
Yeah, like it's like most of Dollman versus Demonic Toys is just reminding you how much you'd rather be watching Demonic Toys, Dollman, or Bad Channels the whole
time. That's true, because at least if you're watching Bad Channels, you've got that Psychotic Symphony, I'm So Happy section that's just crazy.
That band, if there's never been a band I wish was more popular than Psychotic Symphony, because I would love for that band to be huge, because I would see them every year that they were on tour. they seem like they put on one hell of a show. Actually, one of my favorite Full Moon films is not a very popular title. Did either one of you ever see Shrieker?
I haven't.
I haven't seen it either.
That's the one that Dave DeCoutu did.
Yes.
With the two-faced one that goes through the walls or something like that.
Yeah, it like attacks you when you scream. And I hadn't watched it in years, and then I grabbed a copy of it at a convention from the Full Moon booth. And, I mean, it didn't hold up to my childhood memories of Shrieker, but the thing that caught me off guard is that one of the stars in the movie is I can't remember his name, but it's the Asian guy that's in all of the Hatchet movies, that plays like the tour bus guide. is the star of Shrieker when he was like 18. So that was kind of like, oh shit, this guy's been around a lot longer than I thought he was.
Wow.
But yeah,
I wonder if
Shrieker
Eli Roth
is
was a...
still like a guilty pleasure just because I remember loving it so much as a kid, but it is not a good film. And it's another one of those Charles Band, we're going to make a 50-minute movie and put 25 minutes of credits at the end to make it a full-length film.
Right, right. I think my favorite was Dark Angel back
yeah,
in the
I'm,
day.
Yeah, I was just thinking yeah. that.
Dark... Have you seen Dark Angel, Matt?
I have not seen Dark Angel.
Yeah, I think that was it just felt like a cut above a lot of the full movies.
That one in Castle Freak and the Stuart Gordon Pit and the Pendulum.
Yeah,
for sure.
There was a lot of great ones, though.
Well, not at the end. Not at the end.
I was going to say not at the end, and I actually so this week this is the fourth podcast I've recorded this week between Horror Movie Night, St. Mort Show, and guesting on another show. And the other show that I was guesting on, we actually got into a conversation just about how Charles Band, really, there's just this random point in like the late 90s, early 2000s, where you just see him give up. Like whatever, you know, even at its worst, Full Moon, it always felt like there was some type of like care to what they were doing. Like they would, you know, shovel out the money for the stop motion effects and all this stuff. And then it just kind of slowly fell apart where it's just like, you know, we're not going to really even bother making the evil Bong's mouth move. We're not going to bother about making any of these puppets move. We're just going to have someone literally holding a puppet and shaking it off camera. Like,
I think a lot of that has to do with him losing his distribution deal with Paramount, though, because when he had that deal with Paramount, he was pulling in a lot more money for his budgets.
Well, that's when video stores
are
dying
higher
too.
Now. I think I read something that the budgets for Evil Bong 3 was higher than any Puppet Master movie. And I don't understand how that's possible when you compare the quality of those two films.
Well, I'm considering that he's crowdfunding another Evil Bong movie. I don't know.
Because that's what we need more of.
Yeah, sure. Well, keeps Tommy Chong busy.
Yeah.
So, Matt, if people were going to...
Evil Bong versus Ginger Dead Man movie.
Jesus, no.
So, Matt, if people were going to check out Horror Movie Night podcast, would you any episode you'd recommend checking out first?
The newest episode that we released, and this is... I keep laughing because I feel bad about this, but the episode that's going to be coming out by the time this comes out is going to be our Monkey Shines episode, and all three of us are kind of like... disappointed by how that episode came out. So I'm doing this promotion for a podcast where I'm like, don't listen to our newest episode. check out the Odd Thomas episode, which was really just three dudes that were really pissed off that they had to watch this garbage movie. And our episode for Dr. Giggles is pretty fantastic as well. And then, yeah, the retroactive episode for Puppet Master 3, I definitely consider it one of our best. So those three, those are good, like, starting episodes, and then, you know, work your way to listening to the Monkey Shines, but know that even the people who recorded that episode were like, we could do better than this.
That's like our first episode.
Yes,
we were like, we can do better than this.
Yeah, we did.
Well, it's tough. Monkey Shines was tough because it's got some weird stuff in it, but it's about 2 hours long, and the only like really truly weird stuff is about 15 minutes of that movie. So I think we all just kind of left there being like, there's not that much to talk about.
You can't resist that joke. It's about 2 hours too long. Oh, yeah. See what I did there, Josh?
I did. I
see
love
what
it.
I did? I'm pointing at you, too, just because I'm pointing at you like a gun because I know that's gold right there.
Yeah, that is gold. Okay. Great. Well, thanks, Matt. And I guess we'll why don't you quickly just mention where we can find those, and then we'll mention it again at the end as well.
Sure. Both of them are just on SoundCloud. You can check out soundcloud.com/The St. Mort Show or soundcloud.com/Horror Movie Night.
Excellent. Okay, so I guess next we'll just get into the what have we been watching segment, or what have we been up to, I guess is maybe a
yeah,
better
let's
word.
Do our typical yeah. spiel before we head into our topic here.
Sounds good. So Chris, why don't you start?
Okay, well, easy enough, man. Two yeah. movies, one of them you watched with me.
Fair enough.
First one you didn't watch with me, and you should be goddamn thankful you didn't watch it with me, is Luc Besson's latest gem, Lucy, which is, oh my God, like, if Scarlett Johansson wasn't in that movie for 90 minutes and I could look at her in the tight white t-shirt, I'm afraid that movie would have lost me. lots of cool action in the first, like, you know, 45 minutes. But I learned a couple things from this movie. It's about basically a girl who finds out, like, we're only using 10% of our brain, and I've been taking these blue drugs, which makes my intelligence go up through the whole movie.
Right.
And by the end, she's up to 100%, and she's melting down into black muck and stuff. Spoiler for everybody. But
that was a big spoiler.
Total. I said spoiler. Total messy
plot.
But
you said spoiler after.
Well, whatever. But basically, it's what I learned from this movie is the following. That Koreans are evil, and you could not trust them because they're just going to implant drugs into your stomach.
Okay.
And that, you know, Freckles, my buddy Freckles, you know who I'm talking, Morgan Freeman,
oh,
really has no purpose in this movie, and I would have been happy if he would have just been saying, like, what's the channel that he narrates, Andy or something?
Not sure.
Do you know Matt?
I don't.
He does some sort of narration. And he's just like, I would just say, you're smarter than you seem. It's just, no.
That's that was not a good Morgan Freeman impression.
I never said I could do a good Morgan Freeman, Josh.
It's got to be a lot deeper.
A lot deeper?
Yeah.
Kind of like Keith David?
Kind of, but let's not go there.
But Luc Besson, he's miles away from La Femme Nikita, that's for sure.
Luc Besson's been miles away from anything, I find, since Fifth Element.
That's true, because he did write those shitty Transporter movies.
Yeah, they were sort of fun
the first Taken was okay.
Did Luc Besson do that?
Yeah, he wrote it.
Oh, okay.
But, I mean, after Taken 1, it's like, they're going to take you again. How many times can you fucking people be taken from his family? Like, right. Seriously, by Taken 5, they're going to be taking the fucking family cat.
Well, Luc Besson, I mean, I really loved his early work. I mean, La Femme Nikita was great. The Professional was great. The Big Blue was great. And Fifth Element was great. So all four of those, and very, very, like, you thought he was going to be the next big thing. And then I think The Messenger, I think he married Mila Jovovich and then made The Messenger, that Joan of Arc movie. And then it just seems to be
like a death knell when you get
downhill spiral.
Jovovich.
Yeah.
Death knell.
Yeah. Matt, what do you think of Luc Besson?
Really, I think I've only actually seen Professional and Fifth Element, so I'm going to just, from what I'm hearing about his future stuff, just stick with those and maybe work backwards.
That's probably your best idea. Bet, yeah. Anything?
The thing with Lucy that bothers me is, like, I feel like in the last 5 or 6 years, there's been, like, 15 movies that are about how we don't use 100% of our brains. Like, wasn't Limitless the
right.
same plot? Yeah. And, like, I feel like they just keep making different variations of, like, what would happen if we use 100% of our brains.
I think Luc Besson didn't use 100% of his brain writing this piece of shit.
Ouch. Did he write it?
Yeah, and directed it. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about right there.
It's got to be better than that Johnny Depp one, though, that came out that felt like it was the same type of movie.
Transcendent,
because I watched that. That was a piece of garbage.
I watched that one.
Yeah.
I won't watch anything Johnny Depp after he got in tight with Tim Burton and he started just playing, like, characters as opposed to actually acting.
Yeah, I mean, I watched Finding Neverland. I thought that was a pretty good movie, but that Transcendence, even the trailer, 2 minutes feels like a chore to sit through. I'm certainly not going to sit through the whole thing. It's too bad. I mean, I think the guy, yeah, really could have done a lot, but I guess money talks.
So what I'm saying is Lucy, no good.
All right.
Let's move on.
Okay.
Let's move on to the movie we watched last time.
Okay.
Cheap Thrills.
Cheap Thrills was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Cheap Thrills is probably one of the most twisted movies I've probably seen in a little bit. Directed by E.L. Katz.
I can't agree, seeing as I just watched Island of Death. But
that's true. That's true. But E.L. Katz directed it. It was co-written by Trent Haga, who actually worked for Troma.
Yep.
And Full Moon.
Did he work for Full Moon? What did he do with Full Moon?
He was Killjoy in all of the Killjoy movies except for the first one.
Right. You're right. You're right. That's true. Because the first one was when they were more... The first one was the Blaxploitation Killjoy, because it was made for that City Limits label that he had, where it was all the African-American themed horror movies.
Yeah. Right. And if you read Lloyd Kaufman's, I think it's his second book about filmmaking, Trent is one of the co-writers on there.
Right.
And Lloyd constantly makes fun of him for working for the rival company now.
And I think he also co-wrote Romeo and Juliet, if I'm not mistaken.
No.
I could be
wrong. He co-wrote, it was Citizen Toxie he co-wrote.
Okay.
Because he met Lloyd on Terra Firma. After Tromeo.
I like Trent Haga.
I think he wrote Dead Girl too, which is also a
he did, which is messed
movie.
Up. But yeah, this one's basically these two guys. This one guy, he's real destitute. Pat Healy plays him, and you know he's about to get evicted from his house. He's got a newborn baby. He's just lost his job. He's about as low as you can probably get on the totem pole, and he goes to a bar and he meets one of his friends who hasn't been in his life for about 5 years, played by Ethan Embry.
Who hasn't been in my life for about 5 years either.
Oh, snap.
Yeah, but, I was like halfway through that movie before I realized that it was Ethan Embry.
You can't hardly wait.
Yeah.
Is that what he was in?
Well, and then he was
yeah,
that...
Yeah, the masterpiece of teen flicks? Yes, he was,
yeah,
in,
he was
can't
in
hardly
that.
Wait.
And then he was in that Coscarelli Masters of Horror. He played that survivalist dude.
The incident on the...
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay, okay.
In the, like, flashback scenes, yeah.
Okay, well, there you go. I learned something
he
new
has
today.
Range.
He has range.
That kid.
But he meets up with him, and they are reacquainting themselves, and they eventually see this couple off the distance, David Kochner and... Who's that? Amy Smart? What's the actress's name? You know.
Is it Amy Smart? I thought
you know,
it was...
It's
on...
not Amy Smart.
You were drooling over her. You should know who it is.
Sarah Paxton.
Sarah Paxton, that's it.
Yeah.
And, I was going to say, it's the chick from The Innkeepers.
Yeah. So they start doing these bets, like innocent bets, like get that chick to slap you and I'll give you $50
yeah.
or whatever. And then as the night progresses, they get more drunk and the dares get worse and worse and higher up. It reminded me of kind of that Very Bad Things movie from the 90s, kind of like in the progression where it was just, it got more and more dark as it went on.
Right.
Because in that movie, it was like, oh, we're in Vegas for a bachelor party. We killed a hooker. This one's more like, we're going to give you all this money if you do all this crazy stuff. And some of that stuff was disgusting.
Yeah, I don't think we should reveal the stuff.
No,
because
but
it was
some
kind
of it
fun
was,
not knowing what was
some
coming.
Some of it was pretty gross.
Yeah.
It's definitely a one-time-only movie. Like, I watch Cheap Thrills, and I don't really feel like I have any reason to ever rewatch Cheap Thrills. And that doesn't mean that I didn't like it, but it, you know, I got through it, I survived it, and it's kind of like that's where I stand with it.
I'll probably watch it again when I'm feeling dirty.
Yeah, I mean, it was just a lot more aggressive than I was expecting. Just from what I heard about it and even looking at the cover, I was expecting more of a, like, it's a black comedy. I was expecting more of the comedy angle. And I just found it to be, yeah, pretty dark and really aggressive.
It was
like
charcoal black, dude.
Yeah, and just a lot more violent than I thought it was going to be. And, but I thought I've heard that Paxton is getting a bit of flack for her performance because it's very flat. It's very restrained. She doesn't really do a lot, but I thought it was perfect for her character. And I thought she was great in it, as was David Koechner. And you'd know him. I think he was in Piranha 2, Matt.
Was he in three double D?
He was the owner of the water park, I believe.
Oh, fuck. What a piece of shit that was.
Hey, I didn't mind
Such
it.
Such a disappointment after how good Piranha 3D was. Oh
my God. I didn't mind it, but he's such a good, like, obnoxious dude, and so I thought he was perfectly
well,
cast.
That's why when I watched that, I was like, I'm not used to this guy being this, like, dark.
Dark, but still kind of obnoxious.
Yeah.
You know? He definitely.
It almost feels more like his character that he played in The Office, if you remember his character that popped up in The Office,
yeah.
Where he was like that guy who thought that everyone loved him because he was fun-loving, but he was really, like, the most obnoxious asshole in the world.
Yeah, and he always thought all the ladies wanted to ride his jock.
Yeah, yeah, like, I could almost see his character evolving into the character from Cheap Thrills, like, if he had enough money.
Like, possibly.
That's a good analogy, yeah.
Possibly. But, yeah, that's all I got, Josh. Why don't you go, and then we'll let Matt have a turn.
All right, well, yeah, I don't have a lot. I mean, I watched Crystal Lake Memories. I guess that's the main one I watched, which is a 6-hour-ish documentary about the Friday the 13th movies. And I thought it was really, really well done. It was good because each chapter was one of the movies, so you didn't have to sit there for 6 hours straight and try and make it through this marathon. You could kind of watch like one or two a night and just get through one or two of the movies each night. They got a whole ton of cast members. This documentary was based on a really great book that came out a number of years ago called Crystal Lake Memories that was similar style. I believe the book was in that... that style of writing where it was just a bunch of quotes put together to sort of tell a story. Kind of like the Please Kill Me punk rock book, or there's also an adult film book that I can't remember the name of. But anyway, this was really, really good. And I'm really glad I watched it. I don't know how it compares to that His Name Is Jason thing, but I think if you're a if you're a Friday the 13th fan at all, worth checking
out. Have you seen, to kind of tie into what we're going to be discussing shortly, have you seen their other documentary, Never Sleep Again?
I definitely have.
I haven't, because I'm trying to like revisit these series and then watch the documentary after, because I don't remember a lot of the movies. So
okay, of the two, I actually prefer Never Sleep Again.
Really?
And not just because I'm a bigger Freddy fan, but I think that the editing was a little bit more
involved. It's also 2 hours shorter.
Yeah, I think you were giving it of the benefit of the doubt with 6 hours long. I actually think that the Camp Crystal Lake Memories is actually 8 hours long. And Never Sleep Again is the one that's 6 hours long. Wow. But I can't remember. All I know is that both of them are long as hell, but it definitely feels like when they got a second shot at doing this, they weren't as strict on the cutting. So Camp Crystal Lake Memories is really good, but there are definitely parts where I'm like, all right, how much more can we talk about New Blood? Can we just get moving to the next one now?
Is the other one set up the same way, Matt, where they have each chapter for one of the movies?
Sort of. It's the kind of same concept, whereas in like this one, they have Corey Feldman narrating. They have Heather narrating the Never Sleep Again documentary. What I like is each movie does have its own individual chapter, but it's all presented in a really cool claymation style, very similar to the claymation Freddy in Dream Warriors for that little sequence.
Okay.
Where they have claymation segments of the movie being recreated to let you know which movie you're about to watch. And this one, and Never Sleep Again, I also like because let's say it's a 6 hour movie, because I really don't remember the exact length. But let's say it's a 6 hour movie about Freddy Krueger's filmography, but it's also a 6 hour movie about the history of New Line Cinema. And kind of using Freddy as a way to tell the story of how this company became a indie film giant for many, many years.
Because
of Freddy. And I thought that was a really cool way to do it.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. So once I've made it through all the Nightmare movies, which I've never actually done in my life, because I always stop on part five, I'll check out Never Sleep Again.
Dude, there's worse to come.
Yeah, see, I don't know. Part five, I always give up.
Well,
part five is tough. But I like what comes after part five enough that I can stomach my way through it, because I'm one of the few people who likes Freddy's Dead.
You're definitely right on that. You're one of the few people.
and you know, a little bit later, I'll explain my reasoning behind that. But and then, you know, Wes Craven's New Nightmare is definitely an interesting take. I don't know if it's the most fun one to watch, but it's definitely probably the smartest one. But yeah, you'll get there. Just fight through part five, because it is a mess.
Sure is.
But part five's got all that Escher-esque stuff in it at the end that's kind of intriguing. And, you know, you kind of learn that Freddy's, you know, basically has 400 daddies.
Well, like in most of the Nightmare movies, I find myself struggling to stay awake like the characters in the movies.
Jesus.
All right. So that's pretty much all I got. So, Matt, what have you been watching lately?
Well, not as much as I usually do. I started a new job about 3 weeks ago. So I'm getting back into the corporate 9-to-5 world after many, many years of self-employment, which is basically the same thing. So I used to be, you know, watching five to 10 movies a week, depending.
Jesus Christ. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, now I'm down to maybe like 3 or 4.
I'm totally jealous.
Why did
you
change that?
So the most recent stuff that I rocked through was I got the Scream Factory edition of People Under the Stairs. So I gave that a rewatch, and I still love that movie. Probably one of my favorite Wes Craven films, and I definitely think that movie is a hidden gem that people don't pay enough attention to. But I can understand why people don't like it, but at the same time, like, it's got a dude dressed as a leather sadomasochist daddy running around with a shotgun just shooting things. There's something weird in that movie that I love.
I got to check that out again. Who is that? Is that Ray Wise?
All I remember is that it's two of the people from the husband and wife in the movie are both from Twin Peaks.
Yeah, I think it's
Big Ed from Twin Peaks. I forget what the actor's name is, though.
Right.
But then,
I haven't checked that out.
Before recording this, I had a group of friends over to watch "I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker."
Oh yeah!
Oh great!
Which
Kino
the
just
scene with Fly Guy
today.
Is still one of the greatest scenes ever in cinema.
That's the only Wayans brother movie I can actually handle.
Yeah,
is that
because that one has the most like old school parody film vibe to it. It feels a little bit like a Mel Brooks or a Zucker Brothers film in the way that the comedies present it.
What's the name of the pimp guy who has like
Fly Guy's scene where he's strutting around in his suit and his giant boot filled with goldfish cracks.
That's the greatest.
I've never seen it.
The scene where the thing that tops that scene for me is just after the one shoe breaks, because it's only one shoe, and he's running away. He keeps tilting to the right as he's running because his foot is thrown off by the missing shoe.
Oh man, I'm totally gonna buy that when it comes out on Blu-ray since they just announced it. Like Josh said.
Yeah. So that's a great, great.
Like a kind of parody of blaxploitation movies, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do they reference movies directly, or is it just the whole tone of the genre?
Yeah, the chef theme song pops up at one point. I mean, the guy's name is Fly Guy because it's supposed to be a reference to Superfly. So it's definitely, it doesn't directly reference any of the plot lines, but it's in that same realm. I don't think that I think that I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker is gonna get a little bit of credit for being like one of the first blaxploitation parody films, but Black Dynamite a couple years ago pretty much took everything that I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker did and just amplified it by the 10th degree and made a way better blaxploitation parody.
Right on. I haven't seen that either.
Really?
I'm a huge fan of the genre, but there's just so many actual blaxploitation movies
I like
want
Black
to see.
Dynamite, man. I like the whole thing I like the whole thing in Black Dynamite when he breaks into the White House, when he's like fighting the First Lady. It's so priceless.
Right on.
Well, my brother and I always quote the one scene in Black Dynamite where he runs in and I forget who it is, but someone's holding a gun at him. And he throws his hands up in the air, and then all of a sudden, a boomerang of razor blades comes in through the window and slices in the guy's hand. And Black Dynamite just goes, "Ha! I threw that shit before I came in the room."
that's right. See, he does a better David Keith than I do.
Is it David Keith?
Or is it Keith David? I don't freaking know.
it's the guy who played Spawn.
Oh, Michael! Michael
what his name
J.
is? That's
White.
Who plays Black Dynamite, I think.
Yeah, he
Michael
also.
White, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, and even the comic book spinoffs were pretty good.
Yeah, there was
and what I like about Black Dynamite is that there's a lot of intentional continuity errors that really make that movie fun. One of the jokes that I actually missed the first time I watched and caught the second time is the scene where Black Dynamite goes to make a dramatic statement and he bangs his hands on the table and he jumps up and you hear the sound of his head smashing into the boom mic and the camera pans up and the boom mic is stuck in his hair and it just slowly lifts back out of the frame. But they just keep playing out the scene as normal as if that didn't happen. And it's a lot of little stuff like that that make that movie so charming and it's in exactly what it wants to be.
Cool.
You haven't seen that, Josh?
No, man.
I'll have to lend you my Blu-ray.
Yeah, Josh, you got to watch Black Dynamite.
Too many...
I'm going to be very disappointed if the next episode of Good, Bad, and the Wretched doesn't have Black Dynamite.
My friend Kent's been trying to get me to watch this movie for literally 4 years, but we just never seem to be able to get together to actually do that. But yeah, I mean, there's just so many movies in the actual genre, because I do love the genre, that I'm still trying to see that. I don't know. I just never
think
about
it. We know what your favorite
it.
Is, Josh.
What's my favorite?
Velvet Smooth.
Hell no, it's not.
Oh, man. Why didn't you tell us about Velvet Smooth?
I don't remember Velvet Smooth that much, except for that scene where she was... No. Velvet Smooth?
Yeah, you know Velvet
That's
Smooth.
That's a terrible movie. I don't remember it at all.
That's why I said it.
Yeah, it's terrible. It's terrible.
Anyhow.
But that's all I've seen besides, you know, the stuff I have to watch for horror movie night, like Monkey Shines recently.
I thought you dropped a spoiler on me, and now you're not going
to
tell me?
Well, there's not much to talk about. I did watch Gnaw Food of the Gods 2, and it's not very good.
Oh, man. All I remember about
not
that...
not very good.
Oh, shit. The only thing I remember about that movie is the swimming pool scene.
And the really weird sex scene, because that's the part that I remember.
I don't remember that, but I also remember the fact that there was a large, oversized baby who just stomped around for no purpose in the entire movie. That's all I remember. That's one of those awesome Canadian tax shelter movies that were always bigging up, where they like, let's go to Canada and make a movie for cheap, and then they get all their money back. So we've produced a lot of stuff in this country.
I will throw out one movie that I've mentioned on the Horror Movie Night podcast twice now, and I'll bring it up again because I do think that it's a really just piece of shit, but people should check it out sometime. Have either one of you ever seen Rock and Roll Frankenstein?
I actually like that movie. I don't think it's a piece of shit.
I have it somewhere.
I think it's super charming in how bad it is, but
it's like a Hidden Lauder movie.
Yeah, I've seen it for the first time about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I still can't stop thinking about it. I'm like, this movie was so fucking weird. Specifically, a penis that belongs to Liberace talking in Liberace's voice throughout the entire movie.
Is that the one where there's like a blonde on the cover, like kind of all over this, like...
Yeah, he looks kind of like Elvis, yeah, and she's like hanging off of his leg.
Yeah.
It's put out by like EI Cinema.
I have that somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah, I have it. I still have it. I think that's a fun movie.
Yeah.
It's like a Hennen Lauder movie, only a little bit more low budget, if that's possible.
Nice.
Is that all you got there, Matt?
That's all I got. So right, want to go to the topic, I am ready.
Let's head in. So we're doing another movie specific, and unlike Street Trash, we're kind of streamlining the hell out of this bitch. So we're doing A Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge from 1985, directed by Jack Sholder, written by David Chaskin, and starring Mark Patton, Lisa Myers, and Robert Englund, of course, as Freddy Krueger. And at this moment, we're going to play a trailer for you. So once that's done, we'll start talking about the movie after I do a brief plot summary.
Someone is coming back to Elm Street. He is not friendly. He is not patient.
Kill for me!
And he is not a welcome visitor.
No!
But he has something terribly special for the new kid on the block.
It started to happen again.
Dad!
I'm in trouble. You've had some scary dreams, okay? Help!
Daddy can't help you now.
There's something inside him.
Monica! Fight him! You're not afraid of him. He doesn't even exist.
Freddy Krueger is back on Elm Street. Watch out for him. He'll be in your neighborhood soon. A Nightmare on Elm Street, Part 2.
You are all my children now.
Freddy's Revenge.
Okay, so that's Nightmare on Elm Street 2 trailer. Yeah, it doesn't really make me inspired, but... let's do a little plot summary and then we'll jump into the movie here. So, 5 years after the events of the first film, Jesse Walsh moves in with his family into the former home of Nancy, the lone survivor of the series of attacks by a dream-stalking monster, Freddy Krueger. Soon, Jesse is plagued by nightmares and being paid visits from our claw-handed killer. Turns out Freddy needs a host body to carry out his gruesome vendetta against the youth of Springwood, and that Jesse is the perfect vessel for his revenge. While Freddy gains influence and does some killing along the way, of course, Jesse and his girlfriend Lisa race against the clock, trying to figure out how to stop our burnt-up murderer. So yeah, let's open the floor up to Freddy's revenge here, and let's start with that opening scene where it's all tranquil and it's the school bus tearing down the street, and you're thinking, this can't be a Nightmare on Elm Street movie. What are they doing?
This is certainly all I remembered about this movie.
Just the opening scene?
This is what, when we talked about doing Freddy's Revenge, this is the scene I was remembering.
Well, remember why I said we're doing Freddy's Revenge? Because I'm like, everyone fucking does Nightmare on Elm Street. Let's do part two.
Well, there's definitely lots to talk about part two. But yeah, I mean, well, the cool thing I thought about this scene, because it's right at the beginning, but I don't know if you noticed, but the driver of the bus is Robert Englund with no makeup.
Yep.
Which is, I thought was kind of a cool take. But yeah, it's we are introduced to our lead character, who actually looks the coolest in this scene than in any other scene.
How is that possible? He doesn't look cool in any
scene. Yeah, but he looks like a freaky, like, I'm going to go bomb the high school.
Well, because he's all nervous and jittery and, like, trying to open the windows. And
yeah, and there's just two cute girls on the school bus, and everyone gets off the bus except for, I don't know why those two girls stayed on the bus. Like, it would have been more effective if it was just, like, a lead guy.
Well, you know, they were the last stop, and they're more fodder for Mr. Fred.
There was no reason for them to be there, though.
Oh, Jesus.
Anyway, they go. Freddy then drives the school bus out into the desert, and they end up on some sort of mountain precipice.
Well, the whole ground falls apart, and they're like on these pillars, and I thought that was actually a pretty cool effect.
Yeah.
I mean, they're teetering on the brink of hell.
At this movie's worst, it does have some really cool sequences in it. I mean, we'll get to it eventually, but I would say that Jesse's transformation sequence is one of my favorite moments in any of the Nightmare on Elm Street movies. But you got to sit through an hour of garbage to get to it.
I kind of thought it was cool how, like, you know, they're on the bus, and eventually they find out their driver's Freddy, obviously, and he's, like, coming towards them with that menacing, like, I'm scraping my claws along the seats, and they're clicking together and everything. And that's kind of cool. But the best thing about that scene is when they cut away to a tomato being sliced.
That was pretty good. I mean, the scene obviously stands out. Like, I mean, it's obviously made an impression on me since the 80s till now, because it's all I fucking remembered about this movie.
Really?
Well,
that's
I think the best part is that, in case you weren't positively sure that this movie was one of the first movies to have a male survivor girl, you get to hear Jesse's girly scream as he wakes up from the nightmare.
He does that fucking thing so much in this movie that by the end, I was just like, we should just put his scream on a loop. And that's our whole episode right there.
Jesus. The girly scream?
Yeah, the girly scream. He does that like at least 4 or 5 times in this entire movie.
That line, his sister's line afterwards, though, is so great. It's like, Mommy, why can't Jesse wake up like normal people?
Well, because, you know, he's moved into the Elm Street house, and he's plagued by nightmares, you know? It's fully understandable if you're going to move into a house where someone 5 years prior has fought off a dream demon that this shit's going to happen. And It tries to do that idyllic, like, oh, new kid in town, let's make his family, like, kind of like all-American. But you can't have an all-American family when Clue Gulager's your dad, really.
That's true.
I mean, the guy fucking does home renovations in a pair of shorts with sandals and socks. I mean, it doesn't get much more hardcore than that, does it?
No, and I mean, especially after Return of the Living Dead, it's kind of hard to picture Clue as anyone's dad.
Well, that's true.
But I did like how he called his son Buddy Boy, just like he called Freddy in Return of the Living Dead Buddy Boy.
Oh, really? I didn't catch that.
Yeah, he did. He did it once right at the beginning.
Well, that's so they tried to establish, like, you know, uh-oh, Jesse's being plagued by nightmares. And then they introduce Lisa, who's like the girl next door type, right? And she's like, she looks... I'm like, the minute she shows up at the screen, I'm like, holy shit, is that Meryl Streep? Because she looks so like Meryl Streep in this movie. You can't deny that.
Yeah, and then, it's kind of knowing that she looks like that. But she's cute, though.
Yeah, she's kind of cute, but, like, why is she hanging out with Jesse?
I don't know.
Like, how did they meet?
Well, they're just friends.
But how do they get friends? He's new to town. How does he get this chick who's, like, okay, like, she generally hot.
She needed a ride.
She needed a ride.
I was going to say, she needed a ride, or every girl wants a gay best friend.
What kind of ride did you want, Josh?
Well, she wasn't going to get that kind of ride.
Well, since we're talking gay, even though no offense to all you PC people out there, did you find that like, it cuts to them in the high school, right? And they're playing baseball. And this like, did you not find this introduction to Grady, who plays like Robert Ressler plays Grady, and he's kind of like befriends Jesse. Didn't you find this to be like super homoerotic in the sense that they're playing baseball and when he goes to tag him out, he pants him? So his pants are around his ankles and it's like, what the hell is going on right about now?
Okay, how did the pants come off again?
He like tackles him and pulls his pants down and then Lisa's just like, ooh, look at that. You know, and it's kind of like, I don't remember anyone getting pants when I was in high school.
Okay.
There is a, I mean, they talk about it at great length in the Never Sleep Again documentary, but essentially this movie, it did earn the title on crack.com many, many years ago as being the gayest horror film ever made. And, in that documentary, it was finally revealed that is intentional. But, not to everybody involved in the movie, but because the writer, I think it was the writer, the set dresser, and the lead actor were all gay.
Yeah.
And they knew what they were doing and put in all these little hints in the script and in the performance and in the set dressing of the movie. But, you know, the director had no clue. Most of the other actors had no clue. Until about the time that documentary came out, where the writer's like, yes, no, the movie is a gay allegory.
But it's like you said, Josh, before we started here, you were like, if you weren't looking for that stuff, you might not have seen it. Like, I knew the history of the movie going in, that it was like this parable for homosexuality and all that stuff. But you kind of said, eh.
Yeah, I didn't. Okay, so when I first saw this
movie,
when
I was a kid, I didn't notice it.
I didn't get the gay. And even watching it now, yeah, there were a few moments, but I, you know, looking for the gay stuff, I certainly could find it, but I wasn't sitting there going, this movie is all about homosexuality. Now they're saying that the whole like Freddy thing, you know, one of the things they talk about is the whole Freddy thing is a metaphor for him like trying to come out, like trying to come to terms with his homosexuality. So is,
well, I remember in the movie him saying all the time, like just these thinly veiled things about how he wants to be inside Jesse and stuff.
But going back to the baseball scene.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of gay.
A little bit, a little bit.
I mean, there's, I don't know. And again, I didn't see this movie for the first time until I was probably like late junior high, early college. But even then, I mean, there are scenes where it's, I mean, there's a scene in a gay bar. Like,
it's not actually a gay bar. It's more of an alternative bar because there are actually women in that bar. They're pretty butch, but I didn't get that impression from the movie. It was more of like a masochist bar, I think.
I guess, okay, so a leather daddy bar, I guess, yeah, is the best way to describe it. But yeah, there's definitely like these weird moments, or even just like I said, he is a male final girl.
Yeah.
His whole story arc is more of a final girl's story than like the male hero of a film.
Yeah, I found that to be a weird shift for this series, because if you look at all the other entries in the series, there's no male protagonists in them. And I think they realized after part two came out, they're like, we've made a huge mistake here. We should have just kept with the female protagonists, because although you do bring up a good point, Matt, with the screaming, that, you know, I could get it confused if I was watching this movie with my eyes closed.
Yeah.
But maybe they were just trying for something different. Like they were just trying to shift everything from the way it was originally. And, you know, I mean, I've seen enough movie about frat boys. I don't think that pulling down someone's pants on a ball field is totally bizarre.
I think frat boys are secretly gay, though. That's what I think.
Maybe.
I mean, come on.
Yeah, maybe. I don't agree with you at all.
I think all frat boys are Lamar from Revenge of the Nerds. That's what I think.
I'm totally conflicted right now.
You're conflicted? Why, were you a frat boy?
No, God, hell no.
Well, then why are you conflicted?
Well, I don't know.
But I like how this scene does introduce us to Coach Schneider.
I didn't think the Robert Wrestler character seemed like he was homosexual.
There is a line later that I'm going to bring up that actually proves this that he's not.
All right.
But it introduces us to Coach Schneider, who's really a tough ass kind of. He's your typical like 80s teen movie gym coach where he's like no nonsense, gruff, right? He makes them do all these, you know, push-ups because they fought when they were playing baseball and everything. But they early put on this story like, oh yeah, he goes to all these like weird bars. He's into this S&M, which is like Matt was saying, right? And it's just kind of weird because when I was a kid, I had no idea what S&M was, right? Like, why would you? And so I thought that was a weird kind of thing to put in a sequel to a really popular horror movie.
Yeah.
So, you know, he gets pants and then he has his first run-in with Freddy not long after that, which is like probably one of my favorite scenes in the entire movie. Because it's, you know, it's him like stumbling around at night after he's had a dream because the house is over hot, is really hot. And he can't contain, like, you know, he's sweating away and he sees Freddy taking his glove out of the boiler in the basement.
You mean after he wakes up in his tidy whities?
Yeah. Well, he has tidy whities through this whole goddamn movie, but he's smuggling plums. That's for goddamn sure. But, you know, he goes in and he's trying to hold the door closed to the basement, and then Freddy's behind him, right? And this is my favorite thing where he's like, we got lots of work to do, Jesse, you know? And he's like, you've got the body and I've got the brains. And he does that thing where he peels the top
right,
of his head
yeah,
off and shows
kind
his
of
brain.
The classic scene.
And I'm like, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Come on. That is awesome.
Yeah.
But it's like they brought this weird possession angle to Nightmare on Elm Street. And I'm like, well, why does Freddy have to possess somebody to get to the kids of Springwood when in the first movie he can just jump into their dreams and murder the fuck out of them?
Well, and it's another really interesting thing about this movie is that the whole shtick with Freddy is that he kills you in your dreams.
Yeah.
In this movie, there's actually no kills when someone's sleeping.
That's true.
All the kills are in the real world.
That is true.
So it's a total departure from part one.
But the lead,
what's his name again? The lead
Mark Patton.
No, what's the character?
Jesse.
So Jesse does have dreams about Freddy though, and that's where Freddy possesses him, correct? I think that's what I got out of that, Matt?
I actually missed what he said there, sorry.
About him having dreams about Freddy possessing him. Do you remember that? I think that's kind of what it was, right?
Yeah, he has a series of different dreams where Freddy's never out to kill him. It's the total opposite of the previous film where all of Heather's dreams literally involve like Freddy trying to kill her and her waking up just in time. For his, it's been more of like Freddy leaving these weird clues and ways of possessing him.
Yeah, I don't know if I agree with the possession angle of this movie that much.
I don't think I agree with a lot that happens in this movie.
But
I'm always torn on this movie because there's that part of me that's like, well, this is the least Nightmare on Elm Street of all the Nightmare on Elm Street movies. Like, it so drastically breaks away from everything that Freddy's character is supposed to be, and that annoys me. But at the same time, it's watching it now when we live in a day and age where so many sequels are just carbon copies of the previous film, I kind of almost want to applaud them doing a sequel that's so dramatically different than what worked the first time around, just because it's a ballsy move that we would never see these days.
And we also have to remember that Wes Craven wasn't intending this to be a franchise.
No.
So when they went out and made this sequel, they didn't have these guidelines and these like mythos for Freddy Krueger in place that all of us horror fans follow, right? Like they didn't know what they were doing. They were trailblazing this, right? And I think because it was less successful, that's why they brought Craven back in to co-write Dream Warriors. Cause they're like, I think we kind of fucked this up. How can we like kind of save face? You know right. what I mean? Like, You have to remember that. It's a first sequel, and they don't know where they're going to go with it. So you can't really be that pissed off at this movie for that, because there was no template in place for it. But I agree.
There's a few scenes where you can still see the original Freddy that they had for this movie, because story is, and you can definitely tell in certain scenes, that when they went around to making this sequel, they got a little cheap and decided that they didn't need Robert Englund to play Freddy, and just hired a random stunt double who kind of just walked around like Frankenstein's monster, and that's why after about 2 or 3 days of filming, they ponied up the money that that Robert Englund wanted to play Freddy and brought him back. There's like 2 or 3 scenes where you can see in a lot of the Jesse dream sequences specifically, Freddy just looks different. He looks like this lumbering, weird thing.
I didn't really notice that, but I might have to look.
Yeah, I know the story Matt's talking about. I think it was actually just an extra that they had paid. I didn't really notice it. Was there any specific scenes that you can that you saw that in, Matt?
I can't remember off the top of my head. It's like one specific scene where they're walking through like a it's just a random scene of him walking through like an alley or one of those typical Freddy shots where it's, you know, a dark and smoky area.
Right.
So it doesn't really narrow it down very much.
That's interesting that footage is still in there. Like, I just learned about that today, actually. And I was wondering if any of that footage made it into the final movie. So that's interesting.
Yeah, I believe that there is like 1 or 2 shots that are still in there because it wasn't worth like reshooting at all. But the one thing, though, that I did notice rewatching it today for the first time in almost a year is Freddy looks very different than he did in the previous film. But there's elements of it that I like, and then there's elements that I don't like. Like, his nose seems really different, but, like, there's more indentation in his face, if that makes sense. Like, it looks a little bit more like burnt-up muscle in this movie than it did in the previous or future films.
Wasn't this the first movie Kevin Yeager did Freddy's
effects?
I think
so.
The original Freddy was created by David Miller, and David Miller had done your favorite Night of the Creeps and Night of the Comet, movies like that. But he was the creator of the original Freddy makeup in the original Nightmare on Elm Street. But for whatever reason in this movie, they didn't decide to go with Miller again. They went with Kevin Yeager, and most horror fans would know the name from, as he was the creator of Chucky.
Yeah. And the Crypt Keeper from Tales from the
Crypt. Correct. Yeah. But Yeager decided to go with, he wanted to go with a makeup that allowed Englund to have more facial expressions. So I think the makeup wasn't quite as like with the heavy, heavy burns as the original Freddy. They lightened up the makeup a little bit so that there was a little more opportunity for Englund to emote, I guess would be, for lack of a better term. But Matt, you're saying that you noticed the burns a little more in this makeup, which is interesting.
It's just maybe I'm just wrong with how I'm wording it, but it's very noticeably different than the Freddy that you're used to.
Totally, yeah. I completely agree.
And I don't even think it's necessarily in a bad way, because it seems like, especially the Freddy in, you know, Dream Warriors and Dream Master and a lot of those later films, it just felt, he became such a character of Freddy that it just kind of was like, hey, it's that guy with like the red wrinkly face. You know what I mean?
He seemed more glistening in this movie.
Yeah.
He seemed more like they moist.
He seemed like they moist. They seemed like they slapped some Vaseline on him so Jesse could get in there and fuck him harder.
Where the hell
But no,
did
I
that
think
come
that's right.
From?
Like the Vaseline is actually, you're right. It looks like there's just something there to give it an extra gross.
He's got a sheen on.
Yeah, I agree. He looks different. Now, did you guys like it better? Did you like it better than the Miller makeup?
I think I kind of do in certain shots, and then other shots I don't. This whole movie is a very weird movie. When I was a kid, if you asked me to name my least favorite Nightmare on Elm Street movie, it would have been this one instantaneously. But the more that I watch it, and the older that I get, and the more that I like just like really weird movies, the more that this one kind of grows for me, and it's never going to be my favorite. I mean, Dream Warriors is number one with a bullet for a reason. But this is
hang
definitely...
Hang on. We're talking Dream Warriors after the original, right?
Yes. I actually.
Oh no.
Yeah. No, I'm going there.
Oh no. You and I are gonna tangle.
Okay, so here's my thing. Dream Warriors to me, at the end of the day, and I don't get me wrong. If you're gonna ask me which is the better made horror film, it's the original one. If you're going to ask me what the movie is that I'm going to most often watch when I'm like, man, I want to pop in a Freddy movie, it's Dokken all the way, baby.
Well, you can't suffer when you're rocking with the Dokken.
Dokken, exactly. I mean, Dream Warriors has the better deaths. It has the better soundtrack. It's a little bit gorier. It's a little bit more fun. It's just got a lot more going for it in the sense of like, let's pop on a movie and have a good time. Well, as far as let's pop on a good scary movie, yeah, Nightmare on Elm Street, the original, is the scary one. It's the well-made horror film.
Yeah, I'm not going to deny your Dream Warriors love, because after the original, it is my favorite. But I find it weird. It's like me and Evil Dead, right? I always hold Evil Dead 1 as the best. And I know I'm in a minority on that, too.
But see, I don't even disagree with you in that sense. It's just like there's this weird line, and I feel like horror films are really difficult to discuss this, because there's definitely the line between the one that's more fun to watch and the one that is a superior film. And it's kind of the same thing with, I listen to your show every time it comes out. I almost said every week, but sometimes every week.
Sometimes it's 3 to 4 weeks.
But
we're
I've
really
been follow-
good.
I've been following the saga of rewatching Alien, and it's kind of one of those things where it's like, at the end of the day, Aliens might be a quote-unquote more fun film because it's got all these space marines and stuff like that, but Alien is the better shot, better horror film. Yeah. And that's kind of how I feel with Evil Dead versus Evil Dead 2. Is Evil Dead 2, you do have this fun, like, you watch it with a group of friends. I would never watch the original Evil Dead with a group of friends.
Well, yeah, I'm totally with you on that. Yeah.
But Evil Dead 2, like, if you're having people over and you just want to sit around and have a good time with some laughs and whatnot, you put on Evil Dead 2 or Army of Darkness. But if you're watching a film because you want to really be blown away by some creative cinematography and stuff like that, then Evil Dead, hands down, there's so many unique shots. It's such an interesting, like, look what you can do with so little type film. So, I mean, it's apples and oranges in a lot of those cases, too. And that's kind of how I see the Nightmare on Elm Street versus the Dream Warriors in a way.
Josh, here's your chance, man. Here's your chance to say fuck Ripley.
No, we're not talking about the aliens anymore.
So after...
I don't want to turn into a bad movie.
After this awesome scene of... him, Freddy, pulling his brain, showing his brain to Jesse. It's like gay alert number two coming for me, right? Because he has that scene where he's like, his dad's like, you can't go out until you go clean your room, right? And he goes up to his room, and what the fuck does this guy do?
He starts dancing.
He puts
around.
On some fucking sunglasses. Yeah. He gets this piece of wood, and he like grinds his hips to it while the song "Touch Me All Night Long" by frickin' Wish plays.
Yeah, and nope. That's, I think it was actually...
Did you ever dance in your fucking room to a song like that?
Yeah, I did.
Bullshit.
But not to a Kathy... Okay, so I think their song was originally done by Kathy Dennis.
Was it really?
I think this is a cover. I don't know why I know that. I used to work in a record store around this time.
Oh, see, he's using excuses now.
So here's the thing, though. This is one of my favorite tropes in 80s films. That is very much gone now, and it's a shame. But the horror movie dance sequence, because you have Jesse in this movie, you have the sister in Troll 2 has her little weird dance sequence, and then you have the punk chick who dies while doing the robot in Friday the 13th Part 5. And I think all those movies were like within like a year or two apart. So I don't know what was going on in like that 85, 86 range, but... Death by Dance was a thing.
Well, you also got that Girls Just Want to Have Fun sequence, The Night of the Comet, that was kind of like this as well.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just saying.
But this sequence, okay, so the thing is that he's kind of caught in the act of his dance by the girl that he's that's kind of interested in him. Now, if I walked in and I was a girl and saw this dude doing,
you'd be like,
shit,
"Fuck this, I'm out."
Yeah, like you'd kind of know, like, okay, this isn't gonna happen.
I think I've just found myself a GBF.
He's not into me, especially when he does that little like ass tap against the drawer.
Oh, fuck. Seriously, seriously. That, I'm just
what,
like...
Do you expect him to close that drawer with his hands like a savage?
Well...
Come on, man. I know when I'm at home and I'm closing drawers, I'm fucking ass-cheeking that shit.
Yeah, and I don't think I've ever danced around in my... Well, I don't like to dance. I mean, because... I just don't dance, personally.
Might as well just say you don't like to live, Josh.
No. I don't dance, you know, and I always kind of, yeah, I don't know if we want to.
You miserable son of a bitch.
Did you grow up from that city from Footloose?
No, I just think, you know, like, I just, you know, whenever I'm at, whenever I'm, you know, when I'm at a wedding or something and, like, all the people are dancing, I'm just thinking... What would Swan from the Warriors do? And he sure as hell wouldn't be out on the
but
fucking dance
floor. But dude, you could totally do the white boy dance.
No.
Where you just like move your legs.
Don't do it.
I'm not doing it. But
don't do, you just
the white boy shuffle,
you,
I like
you're
to call
doing it.
You
in
just
your chair.
Bounce back and forth and do something with your arms the whole time.
I'm doing it because you love
Chris
it.
Chris is doing it in his chair right now.
Does this turn you on?
No.
Should I go close some drawers with my ass?
Okay, no. Let's just not do that.
So after this gay... I like to call them gay alerts, unfortunately. If you're offended by this... You know, whatever. But
it sounds like something you can download on your computer.
Gay alert! Gay alert! Gay alert! Gay alert! Yeah, I mean, I think it's called Gaydar.
Well,
so she has none of that, apparently.
Apparently not. But after that, they actually find Nancy's diary in the bedroom.
Yeah, beside a game called Probe.
I didn't notice that
there was a board game in the closet. In the closet.
That would explain the production designer's input into this.
Called Probe.
Jesus. Probe, huh?
But, yeah.
How could you miss that?
I don't know.
It was like this huge letters, Probe.
What I want to know is...
I believe he also has a sign in his room that says, no chicks allowed.
Yeah, that's true. On the door, right?
Yeah.
Maybe on the closet door.
I would just like to know how Nancy's diary is still sitting in this closet for them to find. And then when she's reading it... When Lisa's reading it, they're like acting like it's this Harlequin romance novel. They're like, he comes to me at night and, you know, he's got a terrible burned face. And all of a sudden they're like, what the fuck is this all about? I'm a little bit confused right now.
I know. And she's thinking she's going to get some action and he's thinking of Robert Ressler.
Maybe. He's thinking of Robert Ressler. You're right.
I was thinking of Robert Ressler.
What?
But
I didn't find this like... There was a lot of stuff in this movie, like, because it leads into, you know, Freddy coming in and trying to, like, possess Jesse again after this, right? Because now Jesse's aware that, you know, there's some shit that went down in this house. And I didn't find their blending of the nightmare and the reality to be that well. Because, you know, there was, like, scenes in it that you weren't sure what was what. And it was just the way they staged it was so poor. And you're just sitting there going, well, you know, I don't... If Freddy's going to kill people, why doesn't he just kill people in their fucking dreams? Why does he need this little wimpy, girl-screaming, ass-bumping Jesse to do his bidding when he didn't need that in part one, right? Like, I'm always circling back around to that when I think about this movie.
Yeah, I mean, if
I think that that's what, yeah. at the very least, even the worst of the Freddy sequel. And you know what? This is also the issue with Dream Child, because I think Dream Child... also raises these questions of, like, you know, why is he going through such a complicated way of getting to these people when it seems like the old way worked perfectly fine all the other times?
Yeah, there's no flaws in your plan, Krueger. Like, no,
yeah,
fucking
he did
flaws.
Pretty good in part one. I mean, I don't know why you'd change that shit.
But after they find the diary, there brings that other scene that I love, which is the crazed parakeet scene. You know what I'm talking
so
about.
It's so good. It's so good.
Like, they put the blanket over the parakeet and they're like, oh, they all have their thing where they all walk in the living room like, oh my God, it's so hot in here. And all of a sudden that cage starts rattling.
Yeah.
And you know what's up.
You do.
You know. That parakeet goes ape. And then explodes into a ball of flame because, you know.
It was pretty amazing.
What would you expect?
I think I read somewhere that they were kind of bummed out that they had actually shot the scene. They had regretted shooting it.
It was the writer who said that.
And I think Clu Gulager got injured during that scene
because I remember on that Never Sleep Again documentary, I remember writer David Chaskin talking about that, like, oh, I wrote this elaborate scene for this bird and everything, and I'm like, a parakeet, really? Like, seriously?
Well, what's really interesting about the Never Sleep Again documentary also is that I feel like Freddy's Revenge gets almost as much discussion time in it as the original Nightmare on Elm Street movie. And like all the other movies don't get that much time. They get like a decent amount of time. It's not like, you know, there's an hour one is dedicated to Nightmare on Elm Street and hour two is Freddy's Revenge and then everything else gets 10-minute segments. But they definitely seem to know that the first movie is a legend and it's worth discussing for all of those reasons. And that the second film has this insane cult following because of how weird it is. So we have to make sure that we address all of the questions that anybody's ever had about this weird movie.
Well, speaking of weird, I know that when I wake up in the middle of the night and I'm kind of sleepwalking like Jesse is in this movie, I'm going to go to that S&M bar that Matt mentioned earlier, you know? I'm going to walk down the street with my shirt open.
Featuring New Line Cinema's president, Bob Shea.
As the bartender. Why don't you just throw in, like, why doesn't the minute he walks into this bar, they just cue up that music from the Police Academy movies? Like, seriously. You know what I'm talking about? When they walk into the Blue Oyster. You know what I'm talking about. Like, why don't they just clue that up? And this scene really has no purpose apart from, like, oh, Coach Snyder's in there. He's a fucking pervert.
Wait, was this part of the gay subtext?
It totally was, because, come on. Oh, I know what you're doing here, Josh. Touche.
Yeah.
This is like, remind me of that movie Cruisin' with Al Pacino.
It totally reminded me of Cruisin'.
Yeah, which is a William Friedkin lost masterpiece. Have you heard the story about Cruisin' where he filmed like 30 minutes of just gay porn just to piss off the studio?
I think I recall that story.
So amazing.
Yeah, Friedkin's pretty awesome.
But when he's there, the coach, you know, he goes to get a drink and the coach slaps his hand on his shoulder. And then the next thing you know, Jesse's running laps at the gym.
Because he was underage drinking.
But the thing is,
so the coach is still working even when he's out.
But the thing is, I'm pretty sure that when you're not in school, teachers can't do shit to you.
This teacher's dedicated, man.
I guess so. He's so dedicated.
Yeah.
This guy, when he's not dedicated to getting a little piece of action from another dude.
Now, we don't know it was a gay bar.
Well, no, we don't. But it's just the tone there. You like, remember, it's the tone. It's a weird tone.
Yeah, it's a tone. I wonder what was on the soundtrack in that scene.
What was it?
I don't know.
You don't remember?
I don't remember.
You usually have meticulous notes.
I do. I was tired last night. Oh, and just so everyone knows, just if I'm kind of down on this movie, it's because I watched part one and part two back to back.
Yeah, and I told you that was a mistake.
Yeah.
But after he takes him back to the gym, we get gay alert number 3. So let's do our gay alert sound. Did we decide on what our gay alerts are? That's pretty good, man. Pretty good. But he ends up doing his laps, and then he's in the shower, and then Coach Snyder's off in his office, and everything starts, you know, going crazy, and he gets hit with the golf balls and the basketballs.
So he's pulling out ropes for some reason.
Yeah, the skipping ropes.
So what's the deal? Like, is he going to go tie up Jesse?
No. No, it was
so the coach is like pulling out ropes.
He's
Jesse's
in the supply room. He's putting the shit away.
Yeah, but no, he's pulling out ropes, and then he goes into the. Something happens, and then he starts getting pelted with balls.
Well, you know, maybe he's hoping he's going to get pelted with balls.
Like, why? Like, I'm guessing this is another inside, inside thing where they're trying.
I think that you're okay. So, like you said, if you weren't looking for the subtext, you probably wouldn't have mentioned it. But you sure as hell, when you started talking about scenes out loud, probably started to catch some of the subtext, because you literally just said the man was pelted to death by balls.
Hell yeah, he was. But he gets, you know, and then it was kind
and then
of
bare ass whipped by a yeah, by yeah. a towel.
Like, it's kind of cool that like he got dragged away into the showers by the skipping ropes around his ankles, but why does he get strung up and get all his clothes ripped off?
Yeah.
Why does he get like locker room antics of the, you know, rolled up towels whipped into his ass?
It's true. It's
like, why?
And then Jesse, does he turn into Freddy?
Well, he gets sliced in the back by, you know, it's the typical, like Matt said, you know, the foggy, oh, it's Freddy in the fog. What a surprise. This never happens. And then when they cut away, it's Jesse with Freddy's claw and screaming, right?
Yeah.
So you're supposed to be like, oh, look, he's done his first bidding for Freddy.
Right.
this is going to go downhill real quick.
And he's covered in blood and realizes what's happening.
And he does the girly scream.
Yeah.
He does that girly scream. But, you know, this is when, actually, this was the first time I noticed the girly scream. Unlike you, Matt, I didn't notice it the second time. And then I was like, wow, he really hits those high notes in this scene. I'm like, I don't know what's going on with him. But I kind of like that scene in a sense leading up to it. The payoff is kind of like you're sitting there going, yeah, he took a towel to the ass. I'm not sure what's going on right about now. But it continued on this possession path for a while, right? Like, remember after that, there's no repercussions, really. There's just the kids at the school being like, oh my God, did you hear Coach Snyder? He got killed last night and it was really bloody and everything. Yeah. And there was nothing else said. Like, they didn't get a day off school to mourn this teacher. They got nothing.
Well, he was a gym teacher.
Well, the teacher was kind of an asshole. Yeah.
Who cares about gym teachers? Is that what you're
saying? Well, that's kind of where I roll. Yeah.
Well, that's because you were the one who was sitting on the bench in gym class.
I was luckily an asthmatic in high school.
You always got the note from your mom, didn't you?
Josh is unable to take part in gym class this week. Fuck gym class, man. Matt, did you enjoy gym class?
He's not even listening.
He's not even listening. Yeah,
because he doesn't care about gym class.
I agree.
But no one, you just said fuck gym class, so you know you've just put the final note on gym class. I think, Josh.
I never liked any of my gym teachers. Like, I wouldn't have been sad if.
Did you ever have the butch lesbian gym teachers? Though?
No.
Maybe that's just the '80s trope as well.
Maybe.
But he still is plagued by these nightmares even after this death occurs, right? And I really liked the scene they had later where they brought back the nursery rhyme song, you know, the one, right. Two, Freddy's Coming for You, where it was his sister in the middle of her room, like, skipping in slow motion while singing this Freddy chant. I thought that was actually one of the coolest scenes.
I didn't realize that was his sister.
Yeah, it was his sister.
Hmm.
Well, you really were fading in this one.
I was fading pretty hard.
I thought that was kind of a cool scene, and then... You know, there was also, like, and then we lead into the finale, which is where all the big set pieces start coming together, right? Like, there's that big, how can we get a bunch of victims together all at once? I know we'll have a pool party.
Right.
Right? And was it Lisa who was having the pool party?
I believe it was at Lisa's house, yes.
Yeah, and then the parents are like, you know, oh, my parents, they like to hang out. And then the minute they go to bed and the parents are like looking at each other like, oh, fuck yeah, we're going to get it on tonight, right?
Yeah.
They put on like the 80s new wave and they get down with their burgers and shit. All the beer gets rolled out in the...
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is totally like a 80s sex comedy right now.
Totally.
But and then there's the scene with Lisa and Jesse off in the cabana, like the pool cabana.
Yeah.
And was this not... probably the most awkward makeout scene you've ever seen in a movie?
Well, again, only because we know what's going on here.
It would have been awkward regardless.
It was pretty awkward, especially when he starts making out with her, and then because he gets a giant tongue.
That could be an advantage in some situations.
It could be. He decides to run away.
I know. He's like, no, no.
Off to Robert Ressler's house. With his giant tongue.
Wait a minute here, Josh.
So what we're talking about is, yeah, they're making out, and then all of a sudden Jesse gets this.
He gets the Freddy tongue.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Freddy tongue comes out. It's a big, giant, gray tongue, and it kind of goes between her cleavage. And, you know, any other guy would be like, I'm okay with Freddy possessing me
at
this moment.
Or, you know, you just figure your shit out and get rid of that tongue and move on.
Yeah.
And get down to business. But instead, he... gets rid of the tongue and then runs away off to Robert Ressler.
Yeah, and then Robert Ressler's grounded, so that's why he couldn't come to this party, right?
Yeah.
And he's like...
I just can't picture that guy being grounded, by the way. He just seems too cool to be grounded.
I can imagine him being one of those guys just like, what, you're going to ground me? Still going out?
Yeah.
What you going to do?
But, you know, the only thing is that when we actually get into Robert Ressler's room, what's the character? Grady, right?
Yeah, Grady.
Like, I'm sorry, man. The guy has a fucking Limahl poster on his wall. Like,
hey, don't you fucking talk shit about Limahl right now.
I'm going to, because he was a singer of Kajagoogoo.
Never ending story, bitch.
I don't care. That's not a good song, Chris. I'm sorry to say.
You've just shattered my dreams for the entire night.
Why don't you go listen to that and Too Shy back to back?
I know it's a terrible
You can
song.
Dance around here in your tighty whities.
You might like that too much.
No, I might.
And then I could close drawers in my ass.
Ew.
But when he's in Grady's room, there's the best dialogue ever, right? Because he's saying to Grady, he's like, oh, something's trying to get inside my body. Something wants to take control of me. And this is where Grady's like, this is the most logical thing he says in the entire movie, right? This is the most logical line of dialogue. Grady looks at him and he's like, yeah, and she's female and she's waiting for you in the cabana and you want to sleep with me.
Yeah.
Come on.
I don't know.
Like, he runs away with the tongue, and then Grady, who's like, I don't understand why he's friends with this guy to begin with. I guess because Schneider gave him detention.
Why didn't you even think they were friends? They actually got into a fight at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, but they're supposed to be friends later, man.
Ah, whatever.
You're going to let your enemy come over to your house and crash at your place because he was too scared to bone a chick?
I might if I had a Limahl poster on my wall.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. Maybe the Limahl poster is another production.
He also
design.
Had a Power Station poster and a Frank Zappa poster. I think he was quite confused himself.
Jesus Christ. But this is where, Matt, you want to talk about this scene? Because I think you believe you said earlier this was like one of your favorite things.
I think that this transformation, possession, whatever you want to call it, scene is just really well done. And it's really bizarre. It's kind of gross and gnarly. There's just a lot that I like about that scene where, you know, like there's the eyeball on the back of the throat. And the thing that I like the most is the actual effect of the Freddy face popping out of the stomach before slicing through him. And just the way that the prosthetic body looks up against the wall as it's kind of a cool effect. But that's the thing that I always liked about the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, that they have these really surrealistic moments that you can't really do in a lot of the other slasher films. And this movie kind of lacks a lot of them, and like when it does try to do the surrealistic stuff, it usually comes out looking really fake and cheesy and just not very good. So this was one of the few times that it actually worked, and I think that that's why I like it so much, is that it really is, to me, the standout moment of the movie.
Well, I was looking at my notes just now, and in regards to this the Freddy crawling out of Jesse's body thing.
So this is where he's like, is Fred, like the Freddy body's like busting through Jesse's skin,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and my sleep-induced stupor.
This is what I wrote down. I said, uh-oh, it's Freddy's coming out party.
Oh, I get it.
See, like, I was totally on the wavelength of this gay thing the entire movie just because I'd watched that documentary and that article, and I was like, yeah, I'm going to see how many gay things there are actually in this movie. And I think that Limahl poster, I think you hit one on the head there too, buddy.
Come on.
Come on. But this leads into, which is the most slasher movie part of the whole thing, I thought, was the whole pool party massacre, right?
Like, well, yeah. Doesn't Wrestler get it? Like, Grady gets killed.
Yeah,
right?
He gets killed. He gets pinned up, and Freddy claws him through the door while his parents are outside, like, hammering on the door. And There's, you know, the typical slices down the door and everything. And that's kind of neat, I guess. But I didn't really care about Grady that much. Because apart from him being the only sensible one, being like, why aren't you going and boning this chick? I really didn't care about the guy that much.
He was much better in Vamp.
That's true. But, and then there's the pool party, which I said, this is totally where they took Freddy into slasher movie territory, you know, because he's running around the pool party, you know, knocking stuff off tables and like slicing random people's up. There's one guy who runs towards me, like sticks his claws in his belly and like kind of juts it around. So like he's making a friggin' smoothie in his intestines with his claws and everything like that. And I just thought it was weird because a lot of the victims were taller than Robert Englund. So it's like, how is he a little bit scary? He's not really that scary.
Because he's got a fucking knife hand.
I guess, but he's got that awesome, I quote this line to this day, is when he's sitting in front of the barbecue with the flames going behind him. He's like, you are all my children now. I'm like, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Like, that's definitely the best line of dialogue in this entire movie.
Yeah, but there were no kills that really stood out for me.
No, it was just random teenagers being slashed.
Yeah.
If I wanted to see that shit, I might put on like a Friday the 13th or something. Like, Freddy's beyond this. Freddy's, like Matt said, what do you go to the Freddy movies for? Creativity, right?
Like, yeah.
You know, you go for, what's Freddy going to do this time? How's he going to get them in their dreams this time? You know, like, even in the bad entries in that series, you're like, oh, that was cool. Like, there's always moments, right?
Right, right.
Like, and for him to just pop up in the middle of this pool party and just, like, slash people, like, you know, that's what someone could do with a friggin' machete or something. It's nothing original or cool. It doesn't fit with the character.
That's true.
I didn't think. But after that, we really do head to that final showdown, right? Like, the movie's almost over by now. And I don't remember how Lisa comes back into the picture, because I figure she'd be, like, kind of jaded after Jesse ran off.
Because Jesse's just running between Lisa and Grady through the entire freaking movie.
That's true.
So he probably just runs back to Lisa's house.
That's true, but they bring back foreshadowing for this scene, right? Because earlier in the movie, they went to that abandoned kind of factory.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, this is where Freddy did all his killing and everything, right? So automatically, Lisa's like, I know where I have to go. We got to go back to that factory and figure this shit out, right? So there's the...
Do they go together or does she go by himself because he's Freddy now?
Well, he's Freddy, so she kind of goes by herself.
Right, okay.
And then, you know, he chases her down. There's like this big sequence of him chasing her down, but not until they've trotted out the human-headed dogs.
Oh, yeah.
That are guarding the entrance.
Those are messed up.
I just remember that in the documentary, David Chaskin, again, like he said with the parakeet, he's like, this is totally not what I was picturing. And I think a lot of that had to do with them rushing the sequel out.
Well, I think that scene was actually a nod to the 70s version, the Philip Kaufman invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Think so?
There were some creatures like those. So I think it was probably an homage to that, but maybe a poorly done one.
What do you think about that, Matt?
I actually don't remember that scene in the original invasion of the Body Snatchers, so I can't remember.
Not the original,
say
the 70s version.
Oh, the 70s one. Oh, yeah. Man, I haven't seen that one in so long either.
Yeah.
Maybe. I mean, it's possible.
But
did you like
those dogs?
No. I thought
because they were so bizarre.
The rat and the cat were more impressive than the dogs.
Yeah.
But it's like they said.
They were weird, man. Like, I definitely, like, you know, as I was trying to stay awake last night, I that woke me up. Dogs woke me up.
I was like, okay, so they're going back to the boiler room like they did in part one, because some of the best scenes in the early moments of part one are in the factory in the boiler rooms, like when Amanda Wiss's character is being chased down before you really know who Freddy is,
right?
So they were trying to do this, but then they threw in this really, really fucking stupid, like, angle of like, I love you, Lisa. I love you, Jesse. Oh, love's going to defeat Freddy. And I'm sitting there like, why don't they just cue in like Celine Dion singing The Power of Love on the soundtrack right now?
Well, and again, how could they be in love? Because they're, well, I guess they could love
each other. Well, how could she love someone who runs away?
They could love each other as friends, I guess.
I'm calling bullshit on you. Right about now, I'm calling bullshit. But
they haven't even had sex. I mean, how can they be in love?
What are you equating? Are you equating sex with love right now? Is that really what you're doing?
Well, I mean, anyway.
Josh, you're misguided.
The other thing, I thought the lighting in this scene was really weird, too. It was kind of like watching an Argento movie. There was all this, like, weird green and red, like, really, like, in-your-face lighting schemes going on, too. So I don't know what was up with that either. I don't know if they were just trying to be creative or what.
But the problem is, look at the sequels, right? Like the ones that followed this. Freddy always had like kind of an impressive send-off. With maybe the exception of Freddy's Dead, because that was fucking lame.
I will defend Freddy's Dead, but whatever.
You're going to defend it? Okay.
So here's the thing with Freddy's Dead.
Let's do this thing.
Okay, so real quick, and I'll keep it short. I understand why people don't like Freddy's Dead. I will always understand why people don't like Freddy's Dead. Here's the things. First of all, it was the first Nightmare on Elm Street movie I ever saw. I caught it on like USA when I was a kid. But I appreciate that everybody who worked on Freddy's Dead is from the John Waters world. So they were out there trying to just make almost like a parody of a Freddy film. They had acknowledged that Freddy at this point had become a joke.
Is that true? Who was, like, what do you mean by that, Matt? Like, what do you mean by that, that they were from the John Waters world? Like, are actually crew members from, like, John Waters crew members? Or just, like, that was the inspiration for them?
Chris, can you repeat what Josh
said? Oh, you didn't hear him then?
Yeah, that one was really far away.
he just wanted to know what you meant by the John Waters world reference. Like, if people had worked on the entire
crew that worked on Freddy's Dead, including the director and the writer of the movie, were all from the John Waters camp. They all worked on stuff like Crybaby and Hairspray and all that. And if you watch those movies and then watch Freddy's Dead, it makes a lot of sense just from, like, the way that the cameras are set up and the coloring behind everything. It's a very bright, it's almost like an animated movie. It's like a live action cartoon throughout that whole film. And I don't think, like, again, it's kind of the same thing with, you know, talking about Dream Warriors for me. It's not that I think it's a good movie, because it's not a good movie, but I think it's a fun movie. And I think it gets shit on a little too harshly for, like, just being a dumb, fun film versus, again, like, a Dream Child, which is trying so hard to be, like, a dark, serious film to make up for the silliness of Freddy that it just becomes, like, unwatchable.
I actually like Dream Child better.
See, Dream Child is my hands. I mean, if we're not including the remake, Dream Child is hands down my least favorite of all the Freddy films.
If we include the remake, I'm pretty sure all three of us agree on what the worst one is.
I haven't seen Freddy's Dead.
You haven't?
No.
Well, you'll get there, man. You'll get there. And you won't thank me when you do.
Or you might be like, I agree with Matt.
Hey, I'm a big John Waters fan, man. So.
Dude, if you agree with Matt, this podcast is over and you go fucking co-host on his.
If there's John Waters, like, even like the tone of John Waters in this Freddy's Dead thing, then I might really dig it, man.
I admit there's a couple things I like about Freddy's Dead. I just thought it was misguided for a movie that was supposed to be the send-off, right? Like,
yeah.
All the Freddy movies ended with him dying in pretty elaborate, cool ways. Freddy's Dead was just like, hey, let's stick some dynamite in his chest. Spoiler,
but see,
Josh,
like, Freddy's Dead, but Freddy's Dead also has, you've got these cameos from Roseanne and Tom Arnold and Iggy Pop and Alice Cooper.
And Johnny Depp.
And, yeah, like, all these people are coming out and doing these weird segments. It's got possibly the best song the Goo Goo Dolls ever wrote in it.
Did they write a good song?
Yeah, have you ever? You know the song, man. It's the
hey,
one.
They were cool,
it's the one that
man,
plays
back in the day.
Over the closing credits, where it's just like, I mean, the closing credits of Freddy's Dead alone is great because it's just a montage of every single kill scene.
That's my favorite part of that movie.
It's so good. It's.
Oh man, it's definitely better than the ending of Freddy's Revenge that we're talking about here, because
yeah.
Love trumping over all is just, I'm calling bullshit on that.
Hey, love didn't trump over all, a claw shot out of somebody's chest at the end.
That's true, because what they did was they're like, hey, remember how we made Wes Craven tack on that really bad shock ending at the end of the first one? Let's do that shit again.
You know? The one last thing though I want to talk about, because we are pretty much at the end of this,
yeah,
is I kind of like the effect of Freddy melting. I like it's a cheesy, you know, it doesn't take a whole lot to figure out how that scene was done.
Hair dryer,
but it works.
Yeah, like, no, it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. I admit it. It's just the lead up to it where it was just like them proclaiming their love for each other when you have no idea why they're doing it. To defeat Freddy.
She's proclaiming her love for him, and then she kisses Freddy, and then he melts, right?
Well, she says it too. He says it too, like...
Isn't he Freddy, though?
Yeah, but he kind of busts through the barrier, Josh. You really did fall asleep, didn't you?
I did.
But here's the thing. As much as I love I love the Freddy movies, but as much as I love them, they're not exactly known for having good ways to kill Freddy. Like, even the first Nightmare on Elm Street, at the end, like... What does she do? She's just like, I don't believe in you anymore. And then he disappears. Like, it's not... They always kind of had lackluster endings to Freddy.
But it just makes more sense than what happens here, though.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not disagreeing, but I just think for most people when they watch a slasher film, right, they want the ending of that slasher, like Prowler. Prowler is a prime example of how you want the end of your slasher movie to be. Like that dude, like whoever the killer is, brains blown across the wall. Like something over the top. Friday the 13th, the final chapter, fucking machete into the head and like slowly sliding down the blade. Like you want something really gnarly. And Freddy very rarely gets that. Freddy usually gets kind of these lame, lackluster ones. I think the only one that kind of works and makes sense is I think part 4, where like all of the different victims kind of start to pull themselves out of him.
Yep. Yep. Part 4 had a pretty good send off. But so that's pretty much how Freddy's Revenge ends. The Power of Love by Celine Dion.
Well, and then it had that.
Or by Huey Lewis.
Yeah, that's true. I'd prefer the Huey Lewis version. But I'm pretty sure Back to the Future had that shit on lockdown. But it had that twist ending with the, like, you know, they're in the bus again.
Yeah.
And then he's, like, freaking out again. And they're like, don't worry about it. And then Freddy's claw juts out. And roll credits as the bus drives off into the desert again.
Yeah.
So they've brought it full circle. What I really liked about the end credits is actually the song they picked. Because they picked a Bing Crosby song, and it kind of reminded me of them using, like, Mr. Sandman in the Halloween movies. Like, when they use all those old 50s songs in the end credits of horror movies, I can't get enough of that. I don't know why, but I just thought it was a pretty cool song to end it on.
Right.
And, you know, it is what it is. It's Freddy's Revenge. I don't see who he's getting revenge on.
It certainly was Freddy's Revenge.
On everyone. On the audience.
On the audience. So why don't we end here with, we're going to head towards our ending. So why don't we just talk a little bit about if we would recommend this movie. We'll go around the table and we'll go for it. So Matt, you start off.
I mean, absolutely. If you're there, it depends on the circumstances. But if you're getting a group of friends together to just watch a movie and have a couple laughs while drinking some beers, it's not a bad choice because it does have all these crazy, weird moments intermixed in it. Also, like I said before we started recording, I'm a completionist. If I start watching a franchise, I've got to watch the whole franchise. So I've seen this movie probably more times than someone should see it. But if you're a fan of Freddy, it's not the worst Freddy film out there. And there is some really weird things that will stick in your memory for a long, long time, including, you know, the dancing around the bedroom or the Freddy being reborn through Jesse's body sequences. I mean, those two scenes alone are kind of worth your time. Maybe watch it and fast forward or keep the finger steady on the scene skip button, but you could do worse.
Okay, Josh?
Well, I'm a completionist too, as we've been learning as I've been going through these series lately, and yeah, I'm watching a lot of movies right now, kind of knowing it's my last time I'm probably going to watch this movie. This one in particular, though, I think I might go back to it at some point. That being said, I really like really bizarre stuff going on, and I think I'd just be watching this just looking for all these weird things, because there's just so many weird things to look for, especially knowing about all the subtext that's been put into this movie. I could see myself watching it again for that. As a Freddy movie, however, I kind of look at this almost like Friday the 13th Part 5, where I don't really feel like Freddy was really in this that much. I mean, I think Freddy only played for like 15 minutes or under of the running time, most of which was not even Freddy. It was actually Jesse possessed by Freddy. So I don't know if I'd really consider this a really strong part of the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise, but just as a bizarre 80s movie, I could see myself looking back at it. So I'm kind of torn on this, because as part of the franchise, I don't know if I'd really go back to it. But as a weird 80s movie, I think I would.
Cool.
So kind of a wishy-washy answer there.
Cool. So let's see what I would say. I would say, sure, check it out. Why not? I mean, you have to remember, like I said earlier, this was their first kick at the can at Freddy. So that mythos that everyone gets upset about not being in this movie wasn't established yet. I did find it to be kind of misguided in comparison to the original. And I understand why Wes Craven didn't want a sequel, because the first movie's perfect on its own. It really didn't need it. And, you know, all those undertones that we know about now, they're just fascinating to me now, because you, when you're watching it as a kid, you don't realize it. And now when you're watching it, you're picking up on that. And it's just adding this extra perception and level to this movie that you might not have noticed before. And, you know, it has solid set pieces. I did find it entertaining. I did get a few chuckles at the, you know, the girly scream and things like that. But yeah, it's probably my, one of my lesser ones on the scope of this franchise, but I'd still say check it out for sure.
Cool. Just on that notion of the girly scream, apparently there's a documentary coming out about Mark Patton next year.
Really?
Yeah. And it's called
Girly Scream.
No, it's called Scream Queen. But it's like Scream, comma, Queen.
Nice.
I think that's kind of funny.
Sounds pretty good.
Yeah. And
and I'd like to remind people, too, that Jack Sholder, who directed this movie, he did make a pretty awesome 1982 slasher movie called Alone in the Dark with Donald Pleasance and Jack Palance, which is inmates escaping an asylum that has some really cool scenes in it. And he followed up Freddy's Revenge with one of my favorite sci-fi movies of the 80s, which is The Hidden. So he's got that going for him.
Yeah.
So.
And Wishmaster 2.
Fuck Wishmaster 2.
Yeah, I like the Wishmaster
all
movies.
Of the Wishmaster movies, hey, I like man. The Wishmaster movies. I can't stand that fucking series.
There were some great kills
in
those.
I binged through all of those movies because they were all available on Netflix at one point. And, like, man, know what it is that I don't like about the Wishmaster movies besides, like, everything? is I don't like the fucking weird little chuckle that he has. Like, after he grants a wish, like, he's just like, like, he makes this weird fucking noise every time. And once I caught that he made that noise, I couldn't stop hearing that noise in every one of those films.
How's well,
that
thanks for wrecking the Wishmaster series for me, Matt. How am I going to hear that fucking noise every time?
How
I
is that any different from what Warwick Davis does in Leprechaun?
Yeah.
Really? I always thought Leprechaun movies would be better if he just was so stereotypical Irish, where he's like, ha-cha-cha-cha-cha, ha-cha-cha, through the whole movie. But that's just me.
Man, so, Jack Schroeder made a really terrible TV movie about shark attacks, too, that I have in my DVD collection. The 10 Days of Terror, or 12 Days of Terror.
I don't think I mind. I thought the movie was okay, I think, because it's based on true events.
Yeah, I mean, it's based on the true events that led to Jaws, so the whole time you're watching it, you're just like, hey, I remember when this was in Jaws.
You're like, hey, Jaws is way better. So what we have established from Freddy's Revenge, basically, is that the three of us do recommend it, but with slight warnings.
Yeah.
If you're like Josh and you watch the first one back to back with this, you're probably going to hate it.
Don't do that.
Yeah, don't do that. But if you can get yourself a little bit of leeway between the two and you're revisiting it now, maybe you watched it as a kid and you're picking up on these weird things that we've mentioned today, give it a shot. Why not? You might as well finish the whole goddamn series while you're at it anyway, right?
We'll see if I can make it through this time. It'll be like seriously my fourth attempt in my life to get through the whole series. And like Matt, I'm like a completist. I kind of need to watch the whole thing.
Just remember that you get to that pot of gold that is the Never Sleep Again documentary if you get through it all.
There's two series that I've had struggles with. This one, I always stop at part 5. And The Godfather, I always stop at part 1.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's like me. Saw, stop at part 4.
Yeah, it's weird.
Yep, that's as far as I got in Saw.
See, so there you go. You're not alone, my friend. You're not alone.
I saw more than that.
Oh, fuck. You know, you're like a fucking kindergarten kid making these jokes sometimes. I swear to God. I swear, it's like you're going to start doing fucking knock-knock jokes in the middle of this podcast.
Maybe, buddy, maybe.
Maybe. Yeah. But anyway, let's wrap this bad boy up.
Okay, so we'd like to thank Matt Kelly for being on this podcast and being our first guest and tolerating us. So, Matt, if you wouldn't mind, if you could please let people know where they can find you on the internet one more time.
Sure. Both of the podcasts, the St. Maud Show and Horror Movie Night, can be found on SoundCloud, soundcloud.com/horrormovienight and soundcloud.com/the St. Maud Show. Just throwing this out there, we are accepting people's movie suggestions if you email us at hmnpodcast@gmail.com. Send us some ideas for movies that you think that we should watch. And
Josh,
if we like them. If we like the suggestions, we'll go with them. And I can't believe I never mentioned this earlier, but I do also have a blog up on Tumblr, everydamndvd.tumblr.com, where I'm watching all 3,000 DVDs that I own in alphabetical order and reviewing them. I'm somewhere in the letter B right now.
You have more you have more intestinal fortitude than I.
Yeah, no kidding.
I couldn't do that. I buy too much to actually keep track of that shit. But anyway, yes. Let's do our spiel that Josh loves so much.
Yeah, you go ahead, buddy.
You don't want to do it this time?
No.
Okay, so for us, you can follow us on Twitter at GBW Podcast. Head over to Facebook, groups.facebook.com/GBW Podcast. We just established that bad boy, so have that a look. And as always, www.thevideograveyard.com/GBW Podcast. Give us a rating and a review on iTunes if you'd be so kind, because every little bump helps. And while you're at it, why not give The St. Maud Show and Horror Movie Night a rating and a review on podcast on iTunes as well? That'd be superb.
Great. Thanks so much. Thanks again, Matt, for taking the time for us.
And we are out.